From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Washington Post reporter Leon Dash lived in a housing project in one of Washington, D.C.'s poorest neighborhoods to investigate the high rate of pregnancy among black urban teenagers. On today's Fresh Air, Dash describes his unorthodox investigative techniques and reports on his findings, which were a total surprise. When Thomas Mader was a kid, all of his friends wanted to know if his parents psychoanalyzed him. Today, Mader shares the results of his study of the children of psychotherapists. And critic Stuart Klawan's reviews a new collection of short stories that merges Chinese-American history with funky West Coast flamboyance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. In 1984, Leon Dash began an investigative report on the high incidence of teenage pregnancy among poor black urban teenagers. Over the course of his research, all of his presumptions about teen pregnancy were challenged. So were his presumptions about investigative journalism. Dash says he began his research with the assumption that teenagers got pregnant because they didn't understand their own reproductive capabilities or were uninformed about birth control. But he found the teenagers he interviewed knew more about sex and birth control than he did at their age. He says it became clear that many teenagers want to have babies, that for them, a baby is a tangible achievement in an otherwise dreary, empty future. And it's a way of announcing, I'm a woman or I'm a man. Dash is a member of the investigative news staff of the Washington Post. His editor on the teen pregnancy story was Bob Woodward, who with Carl Bernstein broke the Watergate story. Woodward insisted that Dash move into a poor black neighborhood where he could get to know teenagers who were parents. For 17 months, Dash lived in a basement apartment in a Washington Highlands housing project. His Washington Post series was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It's been expanded into the new book, When Children Want Children. Dash formerly reported on Africa and the State Department for the Washington Post. He told me what got him interested in investigating teen pregnancy.
Well, I had been out of the country for about 5 years as an African correspondent for the Post from 79 to 84. And shortly after I returned in January of 84, a friend of mine told me that half of the children, black children, born in America in 1983 were the children of single mothers. And she added that a third of those single mothers were poor adolescent girls. Well, I found those figures to be incredible, very, very high. And at first I questioned her and I didn't really readily accept the statistics, but then when I checked, I found out that the statistics were accurate. Well, I hadn't really been aware of this phenomenon before I left for Africa in 79, and I wanted to know what was happening in the black community that produced this crisis of such large proportions. And I went to colleagues at the Post, and I went to friends, and also relatives, and asked them why they thought so many black children were having babies. There were a lot of myths tossed at me from these people, well-meaning people, but some of them told me that girls were having babies to qualify for welfare payments, or that girls were having babies because they needed someone to love in their lives or needed someone to love them in their lives. And I found that the girls developed the rationale to have a child, to have someone love them, only at the point where they were pregnant or thought that they were pregnant. It was not the underlying motivation for wanting a child or having a child.
And what was the underlying motivation?
A tangible achievement. Tangible achievement. In a world where their achievements, they saw that their achievements were going to be very few, if any.
Let's talk a little bit about how you wrote this story for the Washington Post. When you were first pitching the idea to your editors, one of your editors told you to start your story by looking at census reports and then to interview experts and then to try to find some teenagers you can talk to.
Right, and that would have been very pedestrian when I look back on it, but that was conventional, the conventional mode of, or the conventional methodology of reporting. We look at the statistics, we look at where the former managing editor, Howard Simons, who had suggested that I approach it this way. We look at the statistics, and then we go from the statistics, and when we understand the magnitude of the problem from the numbers, then we go to the experts. We interview the experts so they can fill us in on motivation and the circumstances under which these children would have so many children. And then we go to find some teenagers who fit in the description of the experts. And that is a quick way of doing it. But it really is, as I see it now, of course, the wrong way to go about it. I did just the opposite.
Well, you started working with Bob Woodward's investigative unit, and explain what he told you to do.
He insisted that I move into the select a community, move in there, and begin interviewing people. And don't talk to any experts. Don't look at any statistics. Find out what people were thinking and doing. And after I was satisfied that I had gotten the truth, then talk to the experts and see if they knew what they were talking about. Then look at the statistics and see from a fresher or from a different perspective how to interpret the statistics.
I guess this would prevent you from going in with any presumptions or any common wisdom that might not really hold up.
Right. The presumptions and the explanations that I would get from the experts, I already had my own adult presumptions.
Right.
They were all wrong.
Right.
Every one of them.
You had an interesting little dispute with Woodward when you were starting the story. He wanted you to rent a room in the neighborhood that you were going to do the investigation in, but you decided to rent an apartment and to buy a little bit of furniture for the apartment, which took a longer time than actually just renting a room. Why was it so important to you to have an apartment?
Well, I wanted a one-bedroom apartment where I could bring people to interview them.
Mm-hmm.
I understood from my own understanding of the circumstances of poverty that most of the homes that I would be going into would be very, very crowded, and it would be very, very difficult to do tape-recorded interviews, which was part of the methodology. And to have a room in a rooming house and be tracking up and down the stairs of a rooming house with adolescent girls, maybe some of whom were pregnant, would look very, very strange to the person who was running the rooming house. I thought it would be better if I rented an apartment, and it would be more effective. It looked like I had come to the community to settle, that I wasn't just a roomer in a rooming house. It looked like I would really be a member of the community, that if I lived there in an apartment.
You describe how one of the reasons why you rented the apartment that you did was because it had so many roaches and they were so brazen that you figured this was an apartment in which there'd really been a lot of hardcore poverty.
Exactly, because from my own childhood in Harlem, I was able to pick up from I noticed that in homes that where people were in deep, deep poverty, those people who had managed to hold on to their pride, their apartments were immaculate. And those people who were beaten down and had sort of given up coexisted with roaches, and roaches in the apartment of the latter group would be very bold and walk on you, crawl on you, and not run from the sight of a human being because they were not accustomed to doing that. When I went to inspect this apartment, these were the kind of roaches that I ran into. They didn't run at the sight of a person. And I knew that then that I was in the right apartment, that I was in the right location. I had known that actually before I looked at the apartment, because for a couple of weeks, what I did was gather a lot of census tract data on the entire city of Washington, looking for the areas that experienced the highest incidence of adolescent childbearing. This community, Washington Highlands, had the highest incidence, 72 babies born to every 1,000 adolescent females, than any other community in Washington. It also had the highest percentage, 26%, of people living in poverty. So I said, hey, this is the community that you should move into.
One editor expressed concern about you. He said, you know, Leon Dash has really worked his way up the ladder. He's a very well-respected, well-known investigative journalist now, and we're sending him into a poverty-stricken housing project where he'll be living in squalor for months or a year or more. Did you ever worry about yourself, about what kind of life you'd be leading for the duration of the investigation, being forced to live in poverty when you could have been living a much more comfortable life?
Well, I was intellectually committed to doing the project the way Woodward suggested it. It was an opportunity. I saw it as an opportunity. And I also saw some drawbacks that it would take a lot longer using his methodology than I had originally anticipated. I had originally anticipated spending no more than 4 months on the mm-hmm. entire project, and I spent 17 months on it. But the only deep concern that I had, I did initially, when I first moved into the apartment, feel a sense of isolation, and that's what concerned David Marinus, the then deputy head of the investigation section. What I had agreed to do for Woodward and Marinus was to write them a weekly letter that I titled Letter from a Basement Apartment, telling them what was happening and how the project was evolving. Because I really detached myself from the Washington Post, and I would only come in on Sunday nights to write this weekly letter and leave it for both of them to read on Monday morning. So when David read my first letter and about the sense of isolation I felt, and my battle with the roaches, because I really, I was determined that that apartment was going to be roach-free, and I eventually succeeded. He was very concerned that I would suffer some emotional setbacks living in those circumstances. But although emotionally I detested the apartment initially, I still was intellectually committed to the project and doing it that way, taking an anthropological approach to looking at this problem.
The residents could tell you were an outsider. How did you introduce yourself?
Well, and that was
Did you make it clear right away that that you were there as a reporter and that you wanted to interview people?
Oh, yes. And I wanted to that I was a Washington Post reporter who had moved into the community to do a study on adolescent childbearing. Well, no one that I initially introduced myself to and explained that to believed that I was a Washington Post reporter interested in adolescent childbearing. Indeed, the person the first male who gave me one of my first clues to why the teenage boys in the community were fathering children, his name is Willie Hood, he initially threatened me. He thought in reality that I was an undercover policeman trying to get a handle on the community's pervasive drug traffic. And he himself was a small part-time drug dealer. He lived in the apartment above mine. And he threatened me with, in a very not a direct manner, but it wasn't very subtle either, that I would probably end up being killed if I went around telling people that I was a Washington Post reporter looking into adolescent childbearing. One of the rationales that he used to tell me why he didn't believe me was that teenage mothers and pregnant adolescents in that community are an unremarkable sight. There are so many of them. So he couldn't see why a Washington Post reporter, who obviously was middle class, would want to live in a roach-infested apartment to get some answers about why these girls were having babies. It was not a big issue to him.
Well, let me ask you his question. Why did you have to live in the apartment to really get the answers? Why couldn't you
had to become a part of the mm-hmm. community. You mm-hmm. know, on the average, it took all of the adolescents that I interviewed, on the average, it took them 4 to 6 months before they were willing to really tell me why they had gotten pregnant. Most of them had what I call an adopted version of how the pregnancy had occurred. And that adopted version included ignorance about birth control, which turned out not to be true, or succumbing to a moment of passion, which turned out not to be true, or being manipulated by a boy who insisted on sex in the relationship and insisted on not using birth control. That turned out not to be true. But before they were able to tell me, an outsider, the truth, I had to become a part of that community, and I had to spend a lot of time with them.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the adopted version versus the actual story.
Mm-hmm.
But first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Washington Post investigative reporter Leon Dash, who's written the new book, When Children Want Children, The Urban Crisis of Teenage Childbearing. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Leon Dash lived in one of Washington, D.C.'s poorest neighborhoods for 17 months, investigating the causes of the high rates of teenage pregnancy among the black urban poor. His study was printed in the Washington Post and has been expanded for the new book, When Children Want Children. Well, you're just telling us that the first time around when you interviewed teenagers, they gave you what you called the adopted version of a story. They basically made up a version of why they got pregnant. But after talking to them again and again over a series of months, the truth started to emerge. Now, we were talking before about how you were working with Bob Woodward's investigative unit at the Washington Post, and he kept insisting to you that after you'd done the interviews that you went back and do them over and over again, that you interviewed the same people on the same subject four different times. Did that make sense to you initially?
No, it didn't, and I resisted it because I wanted to get It took me about 6 months, it took me from July until sometime in mid-January to get all the first interviews done, because each interview took about 8 hours to do, and I would do them once a week for 2 hours or among 30 separate people. So after I had accumulated all of this information, I felt that after I transcribed the interviews that I would be ready to write. And he said, no, I want you to go back and interview each of the persons who you have selected as the principal persons of this series. I want you to interview them at least four more times. And I said, well, this is going to take another year. He said, okay, let it take another year. And he was right. By the fourth interview, the girls began to shed their mask. The mask that they had worn in the first two interviews in some cases, and began telling me about wanting a child and why they wanted a child. The first person who did that was one of the girls who I ended up being very close to, Sherita Dreher. And I still can remember the day that she shed her mask. I had met Sherita on October 30th. She had her first and only child, Marquise, at age 15. She'd had the child to try to hold on to her boyfriend. And she hadn't told me that initially. She had told me that she had gotten pregnant because he insisted on sexual relations, that she was ignorant about birth control, and she became pregnant, and William Wheeler abandoned her. That was not the true story. But she was not willing to tell me the true story. The first story she told me was on October 30th. Toward the end of February, she told me the truth, that she had had William, she'd become intentionally pregnant, because William was light-skinned, she was dark-skinned, and she wanted to hold on to a light-skinned boyfriend. And she figured the best way to try to hold on to him was to have a baby. It didn't work. William knew what she had done, and with great anger and disgust, walked away from her when he found out that she was pregnant.
How did you know that was the truth?
Her sister had told me before she told me. And she had shared the truth with her sister. And I never confronted none of these. This was not the style of interview was never confrontational. It was always me waiting for the girls to reach a point where they were willing to tell me the truth. Oftentimes, a sibling, a brother or a sister, a best friend, or the girl's mother told me well before the girl told me what the truth was. But I never confronted the girls. I didn't want them to draw up and build a wall around themselves and become defensive. So I didn't have the style of the normal journalistic style of confronting the person with the truth. I waited until they were ready to tell me the truth.
Why do you think that they made up stories in the first place? Especially, why did they make up stories that fit our presumptions so well? Our presumptions being that teenagers have children because they're not educated about birth control.
Well, they're not dumb. They know adult presumptions. And they use them. Early on, I think the third teenager I interviewed, Bucci Williams, I interviewed her about why she had had a child at the age of 16. It was the first really initial meeting, me getting to meet her. She was very nervous and very concerned. I could see it because I asked explicit questions. And I could tell that she was thinking about her responses too carefully for her to really be candid with me. So after 45 minutes of that, I turned off the tape recorder and I just said to her, I said, Bucci, you know, you really haven't been candid with me, have you? And she said, no, I really haven't. I said, well, what is it that you've told me? She said, well, I gave you the answers that I would give to a high school counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And that frightened me. Mm-hmm. I didn't want the answers that these kids give to high school counselors. I didn't want the answers and the excuses that they gave to an infuriated parent. I didn't want the answers that they gave to the social worker. I didn't want the answers that they gave to the cold, snobbish official at the welfare certification process. I knew then that if all of the adolescents that I was involved with and becoming increasingly involved with, this interview with Bucci was very early on in the project, I knew then that if I didn't do something different, that all of them would be giving me the answers that they give to whatever official or whatever angry parent they're confronted with to justify their behavior. So I developed a methodology of my own. I understood that if I started interviewing any boy or any girl at the process where the pregnancy had occurred, they would all give me the adopted version. So mm-hmm. what did I do? I said, well, let me start each adolescent out from their earliest childhood memory and bring them forward very, very slowly. And the process followed along four lines in four separate interviews to combine, make one first interview. And that is, I interviewed them about their growing up in their family, about their growing up in the church, if they were active in church life, about growing up in school, and always the last interview, usually in the fourth or fifth week of the process, was their social development, which included sexual development. Inevitably, they told me about passages in their own lives and things they had learned growing up, even before they became adolescents, that told me that they were very, very savvy people mm-hmm. before they became pregnant. They had, in each case, they inadvertently gave themselves away before they realized it, that they had given me too much information about themselves, too much information about how they perceived other people and the world around them, too much information about their fantasies and their hopes and dreams for them to come to the point comfortably after a while, particularly in a repeated interview over the same ground, to say that the pregnancy had been an accident, to say that it had been a moment of passion.
I'm wondering if you've become very skeptical of the experts' analysis of teenage pregnancy, considering that so many teenagers might actually be giving false stories to the experts who are studying them.
I think a lot of that is happening. From my own experience, I think a lot of that is happening. So if I had done it the way I had intended, if I had done this project the way I had intended to, I would have ended up reinforcing experts' opinions mm-hmm. and reinforcing a lot of mythology, and I'm glad I didn't.
Let me ask you this. One of your friends, when he found out that part of what you were going to write was the story of a girl who got pregnant because she wanted to keep her light-skinned boyfriend,
mm-hmm.
he was afraid that you shouldn't be writing about color consciousness among blacks, that that's something that whites really shouldn't be reading about, and that black journalists should withhold information from the press that might not reflect well upon blacks.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to hear your reaction to that.
Well, my former friend, because he became infuriated with me when the series ran, and we really haven't been in touch with each other since then, and that was in January of 1986. So my former friend is not alone in that respect. Mm-hmm. A lot of the criticism that I received after the series ran came from middle-class blacks who were very upset that I had written about these different aspects about black society. But he felt that this is what he called negative journalism. And my position to him and my explanation to him is that I don't see negative or positive journalism. I know what people mean when they use those terms, but I see journalism as a process of trying to get at reality, trying to present information to the general public that presents a reality to them, no matter how grim it is, so that the people who are interested in trying to correct a bad situation work with that situation or approach that situation with an understanding of what is genuinely going on, not trying to wade through a sea of myth and working and putting their resources into the wrong arena.
Now that you've spent a lot of time with teenagers who are parents, does a life as a teenage parent seem any more or less dead-endish to you?
Let me say, four of the six families, the adolescent parents and four of the six families are doing well today. Well, no, it's three of the six families.
Mm-hmm.
I take that back, because one of them was doing well up until very recently, and I've lost touch with that one. Let me tell you something about myself. After the series ran, I dissolved the professional barrier that I kept between myself and the girls that I had grown very close to, and I became actively involved in their lives. And that involved a lot of badgering about going back and going back to high school and finishing high school. In Sharita's case, a lot of badgering and arm twisting, I'm speaking figuratively, to get Sharita. She was accepted at the University of D.C., and we went through a lot of, it was almost like, I have two daughters of my own, and it was almost like a father-daughter relationship, and it was exhausting to me. But I badgered Sharita to go to college, and I got the publisher of the Washington Post to pay her tuition. She, at the last minute, decided not to go, but she can go back at any time, and I think the publisher would still pay her tuition.
If your conclusions are true, and many teenagers are having children not because they're uneducated about birth control, but because they want children for a sense of identity, for a sense of accomplishment, then what do you think we could possibly be doing to inform them more about what life as a teenage parent will be like?
I don't think that you can do much in that area, because, again, that's adult concrete thinking.
Mm-hmm.
If I do such and such, then so and so will be the consequence. I don't find that these kids think along those lines. They think of themselves as invulnerable and immortal, like all teenagers. And they are adolescents, so they don't have all the information, no matter how much information you feed them, that'll keep them from taking the roads that they choose. I think the most significant area that could help turn these kids around would be an all-out effort for them at the elementary school level to give them the educational foundation that they need to finish high school so that they're not 18 years old and reading at a third grade level, that gets them to invest in their own self-interest and therefore postpone having a child and finishing high school so they can go into the job market in the future and be competitive.
Have the experiences that you had doing the story changed your methods as a reporter?
Quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Have had a considerable impact on... I've been a reporter for 20-odd years,
yeah.
And this is the first time that I've really gotten this deep. So I've seen the previous 18 years as relatively shallow reporting, conventional shallow reporting.
What kind of story are you working on now?
The Children of Criminal Recidivists. I've been working on it since August 1987.
Have you moved in someplace for that?
No. I spent a lot of time in the D.C. jail.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for telling us about your reporting. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Leon Dash. His new book, When Children Want Children, The Urban Crisis of Teenage Childbearing, has just been published by William Morrow. Dash is an investigative reporter at The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Sally Bingham. She's part of the Kentucky newspaper dynasty that owned the Louisville Courier-Journal and the Louisville Times. The tangled history of the Bingham family was the subject of two books published last year. Now Sally Bingham has published her side of the story in the new book, Passion and Prejudice. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's sometimes not easy when your parents are professionals at analyzing other people's behavior. Thomas Mader's parents were both therapists. He's just completed a study of the children of psychotherapists. Coming up, he shares the results. Also, book critic Stuart Kluwans reviews The Chinaman Pacific and Frisco Railroad Company, a collection of short stories by Frank Chin. And rock historian Ed Ward visits Mardi Gras. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Chile's military government is preparing to receive former Paraguayan dictator Alfredo Stroessner, overthrown in a bloody coup overnight. Stroessner's second-in-command has been sworn in as president, promising democracy. Tim Frasca has the story.
Access to Santiago's international airport was restricted in apparent preparation for General Stroessner's arrival, expected in the early evening. One radio report said the deposed Paraguayan leader would fly first to an army base in northern Chile, continue on to the capital, then travel by land to meet head of state General Augusto Pinochet in his summer retreat. Chilean Defense Secretary General Patricio Carvajal said no formal request for asylum had yet been received, but that in his opinion, Chile should be prepared to receive Stroessner due to the long friendship between our two peoples. One opposition figure, Christian Democrat Andrés Saldívar, agreed that Chile should welcome Stroessner for humanitarian reasons. For National Public Radio, this is Tim Frasca in Santiago.
President Bush said today he will unveil a plan next week to help the nation's savings and loan industry. At the start of a White House meeting with congressional leaders, Bush repeated his pledge to protect S&L deposits. The administration is considering raising fees paid by the industry to the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation that insures the deposits. A proposal to make depositors pay a fee based on the amount of money in their accounts generated immediate criticism and appears to be dead. Experts say the FSLIC is likely to go broke unless a comprehensive aid package is adopted. Vice President Dan Quayle visited El Salvador today on his first diplomatic mission abroad. The visit comes amid political controversy over a proposal put forward last week to end 9 years of civil war. Tom Gibb reports.
Vice President Quayle said he came to offer support to the country's fledgling democratic process and warn the military about rising human rights abuses. He met with Salvadoran President José Napoleón Duarte, political leaders of the main parties, and the military. His visit comes amid concern in the United States about what would happen if, as seems likely, the far-right Arena Party wins presidential elections in March. Much of his attention was focused on an offer last week by leftist rebels to take part in the elections for the first time in return for a six-month postponement until September. The Christian Democrats said today they would consider changing the election date if all other parties agreed. The parties will meet on Monday. However, consensus is unlikely, with many in the right-wing Arena Party still regarding the rebel plan as a trap. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
The stage is now set for the first Sino-Soviet summit in 30 years. The Chinese government today officially invited Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to visit, and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze accepted. The date for the Gorbachev visit will be set tomorrow when Shevardnadze meets with Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping in Shanghai. The summit could come as early as April. A French journalist is said to be in stable condition after being shot by a Soviet soldier in Afghanistan. A correspondent for L'Express magazine was reportedly fired on as he and two other Western journalists tried to photograph Soviet troops in Kabul. One of the other journalists said the soldiers appeared to be trying to bargain with young Afghans when the shooting occurred. Unemployment rose slightly last month. The Labor Department said joblessness went up a tenth of a point to 5.4%, but the number of new jobs created in December nearly doubled compared with December. Stock prices ended the day mixed on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 2.5 points to close at 2331.25, but advances led decline 7-6 on volume of 173 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. It's Mardi Gras time in New Orleans now, and even though our rock and roll historian Ed Ward lives in Texas, he's still in the spirit.
As I don't need to remind anybody in the state of Louisiana, it's Mardi Gras time. Out in the countryside, Cajuns are running their careers, horseback processions of masked men who pretend to steal food from farmers to make a big gumbo, which is served at a dance at the end of the day. And in New Orleans, well, in New Orleans, they celebrate Mardi Gras with rock and roll. Oh, I know that a lot of tourists have already decided that the appropriate soundtrack is Pete Fountain or the superannuated Men at Preservation Hall. But for the people who actually live there, Mardi Gras and the local popular music have been synonymous since the early 50s. That was when a legendary piano player, Roy Bird, known to one and all as Professor Longhair, first recorded his anthem, Mardi Gras in New Orleans. Actually, the song has a long and twisted history, having been cut in 1949, 1950, 1952, 1958, and many times subsequently. It's catchy and shows off Longhair's patented rumba boogie technique nicely. Here's the 1950 version. Because Longhair's record was so hard to find at first, other local musicians knew they could make a killing if they could just come up with another great Mardi Gras song. In 1955, the Hawkettes, whoever they were, did just that with Mardi Gras Mambo.
Down in New Orleans where the blues were born, it takes a cool cat to blow a horn. On LaSalle and Rampart Street, the combos play with the mambo beat. The Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo. Down in New Orleans, in Great Town where the cats all meet, it's the Mardi Gras mambo with the beat. Shout and cheer for the Zulu King, and truck on down with the mambo swing. The Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo, mambo, mambo. Mardi Gras mambo. Down in New Orleans.
Actually, I know one thing about the Hawkettes, and that is that Art Neville, of New Orleans' amazing Neville family, was a member. There are plenty of Nevilles, as any of you who have gone to see the Neville brothers can attest, since they tend to hire family, and you never seem to see the same ones twice. This means that once you start getting into cousins and uncles, you find yourself squarely in the middle of a Mardi Gras secret society. Now, I'm not talking about the crews here, those groups who parade with huge floats and throw stuff to the crowds. Uptown, the Mardi Gras is different, and for years there have been several tribes of black Indians, groups who get together to dress in fantastically ornate costumes and do traditional chants.
The
Wild Chapatula's chant, "Meet the Boys on the Battlefront," sums up New Orleans Indian life with the competition between tribes, the boasting, and the odd language, which showed up in another famous rock and roll hit.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, "I'm gonna set your flag on fire." You're talking about hey now, hey now, hey now, Aiko, Aiko, Ande, Giacomo Fino, Anane, Giacomo Finane. Look at my king all dressed in red, Aiko, Aiko, Ande. I bet you $5 he'll kill you dead. Giacomo Finale. Talking about hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now. Aiko, Aiko, Ande. Giacomo Fino, Anande. Giacomo Finale.
With its talk about flag boys and kings, the Dixie Cup's Aiko Aiko was Mardi Gras Indian to the core. But it got to be a big hit in 1965, even among people who didn't know what Giacomo Finane means. That includes me. Although New Orleans has a tendency to mummify its musical traditions, during Mardi Gras they live in the streets, in the clubs, and at parties. And isn't that where you're supposed to find rock and roll?
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. Here's some contemporary Mardi Gras music by the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. Fresh air. When Thomas Mader meets people and they find out both of his parents were therapists, he's always asked the same question, "Did your parents analyze you?" Well, that was the first question Mader posed to the 200 adult children of therapists he interviewed for his book, Children of Psychiatrists and Other Psychotherapists. He found out that very few parents actually sat their kids down and analyzed them. I asked him if there were other assumptions people made about him because of his parents' profession.
Well, as soon as people heard that my father was a psychoanalyst, the first thing they always said was, "Oh, well, so that's why you're crazy," or, "Well, why aren't you crazy then?" Depending on what they happened to think of my particular mental health. But it was never in an unpleasant way, but there was certainly a rampant stereotype that shrinks kids are supposed to be nuts.
Where does that come from?
Well, I don't know. When you think about it, it's a little bit odd that people whose training and experience really ought to prepare them better than anyone else to be able to raise happy, healthy, normal, well-adjusted children are reputed to fail on this monumental sort of caricatural scale. And I think part of it is just because, part of it is just a joke that people don't like psychiatrists and psychotherapists. They don't trust them. So I think in a way it's just a joking way to combat people's uneasiness. But at the same time, I think there's a certain amount of truth to it. I mean, the myth didn't just start from nothing. I think a lot of people go into psychotherapy as a profession because of their own problems or their own preoccupations or because they had an unhappy early life and are trying to come to grips with their problems, which in itself, I hasten to point out, isn't necessarily a disadvantage. I mean, I think it can be a positive advantage to have your own problems.
In terms of empathizing.
Sure, you're a more compassionate person and a better therapist as a result if you come to grips with your problems and resolve them.
A lot of therapists have their offices in their home. And I think that was the case with at least one of your parents.
They both had offices in the home, yeah.
What were the rules of the house in your house pertaining to being around where the offices were?
Well, in my house, we couldn't go downstairs. Both of the offices were on the first floor, and we lived upstairs. We couldn't go in or out or downstairs between 10 minutes of the hour and the hour, which was when the changing of the patients took place. And obviously, we always used to hang around at the stairway and peer down and try to see who these mysterious people were and listened at the doors sometimes. And frankly, it wasn't really very interesting. They looked like any other grown-ups, and they didn't really have very much to say that was particularly exciting for a young kid.
Now, was this a common thing that children of therapists would try to sneak peeks at who the patients were or try to eavesdrop at the door?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're awfully curious about this because you know that something extremely important is happening. There's certainly an aura, however explicitly you understand it, of something. I mean, later you know that there's something sexual involved in all of this, and you know that something forbidden and bizarre is going on that that you're not supposed to know anything about and that nobody is supposed to know anything about.
Did you find in interviewing the children of therapists that a lot of them felt that they were brought up according to the school of thought that their parents subscribed to, for instance, brought up in a Freudian way or brought up in a behavioral way?
Some of them yes and some of them no. I mean, some kids of behavioral therapists, and I didn't really talk to very many of them, did think that they were brought up according to behavioral principles. There was one fascinating person that I talked to, Jonathan Moreno, whose father was the founder of psychodrama, and his family was brought up in entirely according to psychodramatic principles, and they used to do role reversals at the dinner table whenever any problem arose. And he found it infuriating. He just wanted to talk about problems. He got sick and tired of role reversals, and he said, you know, can't we just talk and just discuss this sort of thing? The kids were certainly very aware of what it was their parents were. I mean, Freud was the god in a lot of the families because Freudian psychoanalysis had essentially replaced religion as far as some of the parents were concerned. So in that sense, you knew very clearly, you know, what school they belonged to, but you didn't really necessarily know what that meant in any detail.
One of the people who you interviewed told you this. They said, in my family, I was never allowed to hate anybody. I came home from school and said, I hate so-and-so. I'd always have to understand why the person did what he did. The bully was the bully because he was insecure. Was this a typical response that you got from the children of
therapists? Yeah, I think that happened a lot. And almost the worst thing about that is you have to be very compassionate and understanding of other people. Other people, no matter what they do, they never did it out of malice. They did it because of some thing that they didn't understand and couldn't help. But then almost the worst thing is that same excuse is not available to you because you're the kid of the therapist. You've been taught this. You've heard it over and over again. And you should be a little bit bigger than to do the same thing. And it puts you in a very different... I mean, sometimes you just want to be annoyed at the other person. And that can be a very healthy response.
For a lot of young children, their parents seem godlike. You suggest that for the children of therapists, this is even a bigger problem sometimes because therapists sometimes think of themselves as godlike, so the parents seem especially godlike to their children.
Well, I think that's true, and also the children tend to see the parents being regarded as godlike by a lot of people around them, by their friends and by the kids' friends' parents. And
What's difficult about that for children?
Well... if you think that your parents are more of an authority than they are, I mean, it's a little bit harder to break away from them. It's a little harder to contradict them. It can also have a funny effect. I mean, I'm not really sure what the overall effect of it is, but you end up, in a lot of cases, with the kids feeling as though they're sort of the members of a sort of priest class, in a sense, because it's disconcerting for a lot of the kids to have this odd experience where you see your parents tend to be a little bit disdainful of patients. I mean, not necessarily in a bad way, and I wouldn't say that the therapists all look down on their patients, but simply if you do something day after day, everybody has a certain odd attitude about their job, and patients can be a nuisance, and they tend to call up, and they try to call people at home, and they plague their therapists, and they become pests. So the kids sometimes see their parents looking down in a certain way on the patients, and these are patients who have fairly major problems. On the other hand, the parents get very concerned over even minor problems that the kids have, and it sort of seems that somehow even your little problems are much more important than the big problems that other people have. And it can be kind of odd because it reinforces this notion that your parents are very special and important, and somehow you're kind of included in that envelope of importance.
Can I ask you a personal question? Have you ever been in analysis yourself?
No, I haven't.
Did your parents ever want you to be in analysis?
No, they always made it very clear that it was available, that if there were problems, there was no reason to feel ashamed of seeking therapeutic help. I mean, it was always something that was there and, you know, money was available. This was something that was important. And I think that's a fairly common thing, that I mean, the parents certainly believe in therapy, and if anything, they may be overly willing to get therapy for their kids.
The people who you interviewed for your study had the benefit of confidentiality. We know who you are, and if I ask you questions about your relationship to your parents, you don't have that benefit of confidentiality. Are you uncomfortable at all about having written this book about the children of therapists, where the therapists don't always come off looking that good? I mean, how did your parents feel about you writing the book?
Well, my parents are both dead. So
Okay.
It's indifferent to them. I mean, I think they would be, they would have been very interested in the results. I'm a little bit concerned about it in a sense, just because some of the responses that I've been getting from people, mostly from therapists, is that they view it as being a totally negative book. And, you know, I try to be very careful about that because I don't think that it's an entirely negative experience, but it is a book that looks mostly at the negative experiences. So I'm not concluding that they all have problems. And I don't really want people to get that impression because I never set out to trash psychotherapy or psychotherapists. So that's a concern that I do have about it.
What do you think therapists maybe ought to think about in terms of being parents as a result of your book?
Well, I mean, in a way, not dealing with your kids terribly artificially. I mean, I think that some of them seem to, you know, feel that they had a not particularly happy childhood, and through their learning and professional techniques, they want to make life more wonderful for their kids than their own had been. And it's not really necessarily possible, and it's not even necessarily a good idea. I mean, there's something good about kids knowing that their parents are human and fallible and dealing with things on a more human level. And it's certainly not a great idea to immediately farm your kids out to therapy at any sign of a problem and take the quasi-enlightened point of view that we should seek professional help when there's a problem. I mean, it may be uncomfortable to deal with the problems and to thrash them out, but that's part of life and part of growing up and part of what helps the kids establish their own independence and eventually become mature adults who are capable of leaving home.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thomas Mader's new book, Children of Psychiatrists and Other Psychotherapists, is published by Harper & Row. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Hi, Alex. What's coming up?
Hi, Terry. Tonight we're going to sample public opinion, talk to people around the country about how they feel about this congressional pay raise, which now seems set to go into effect next week. We'll also have a story from North Carolina, where two counties have suffered a very severe outbreak of measles. And what they've done is impose a quarantine down there, which has turned out to restrict people's lives in some surprising ways. Those under the age of 32 cannot assemble in large groups in these two counties. It's having some pretty interesting effects on people's lives there. And the story of an interpreter who once carried on a conversation between Mao and Stalin.
Thanks, Alex. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Frank Chin is a playwright, essayist, teacher, and short story writer who chronicles American culture from the vantage point of Chinatown in Oakland, California. His latest collection of short fiction is called The Chinaman, Pacific, and Frisco Railroad Company. Critic Stuart Klawan says the title should give you some idea of Chin's flair for merging Chinese-American history with funky West Coast flamboyance.
Among Frank Chin's many accomplishments, he can claim to have been the first Chinese-American brakeman on the Southern Pacific Railroad. He's proud of that, in the same way that he's proud of his Cantonese heritage. His people didn't come from the high culture of northern China, he says. No, they were like the railroad men, what he calls the eat-and-run midnight people. We were the badasses of China, the barbarians, he writes. We were the dregs, the bandits, the killers, the get-out-of-town eat-and-run folks, hungry all the time. Our culture is our cuisine. There are no cats in Chinatown. That's the tough guy image Chin likes to present. The author is railroad worker, Cantonese badass, American outlaw. Being Chinese in the United States, he says, is like being a virus staying a step ahead of a cure. Well, maybe yes and maybe no. There's a newer stereotype these days, in which the Chinese American wouldn't be a virus. he or she would be a biomedical researcher, working out the cure on a computer. But that's not a very promising image to work with when you want to write with wild intensity and a sense of sociocultural outrage. So Frank Chin doesn't put any Westinghouse science scholars in his new book, just hardcore, old-fashioned residents of a West Coast Chinatown, with the author himself as number one outlaw by birth. Does that make for prose written with wild intensity and a sense of sociocultural outrage? You bet. The 8 stories in this collection vary from the realistic to the hallucinatory, from beautifully clear depictions of the lives of working-class Chinese-Americans to kaleidoscopic tours of Frank Chin's own highly individualistic psyche. The realistic stories tend to be told in the third person. They happen in the vicinity of a character much like Chin himself, a young man named Dirigible, who grows up in and around the Eclipse Hotel in Oakland, California. The hallucinatory pieces are generally in the first person. They tend to incorporate more details from Chin's later life, his railroad work, his divorce, his life as a writer. Sometimes in these more uninhibited stories, Chin gets himself so worked up that he leaves the reader behind. But that's the fault of a very good writer who was willing to risk breaking his neck in every sentence. Frank Chin's fictions were not written by a faint-hearted storyteller, nor are they intended for the faint of heart. In fact, Chin has such an appetite for conflict that he finishes the volume with an attack on Maxine Hong Kingston, the celebrated author of The Woman Warrior. Chin accuses her of grossly misrepresenting traditional Chinese culture. This is not a dispute I would want to be party to, so let me simply say that Chin's own representation of Chinese culture, however realistic or hallucinatory it might be, is astonishing to read. The Chinaman Pacific and Frisco Railroad Company is published by Coffee House Press. If you can't find it in your bookstore, try contacting the press at Post Office Box 10870, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55458. For those of you who are still reaching for a pencil, here it is again. Coffee House Press, Post Office Box 10870, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55458.
Stuart Kluwans writes about film and small press fiction for The Nation. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Kids Radio with Kathy O'Connell. She's the former host of the national program Kids America and now hosts a children's call-in show in Philadelphia called Kids Corner. She'll tell us about not growing up to be the kind of adult she hated as a child. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a recent reissue featuring Laverne Baker singing the songs of Bessie Smith. Baker was one of the most striking and most imitated rhythm and blues singers of the 50s. And television critic David Bianculli previews the return of Columbo. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.